you're listening to a highlight from the Creative Processes interview with economist Daniel Susskind. This podcast is supported by the Jan Mišovský Foundation.
This idea that we ought to pursue economic growth sits at the center of our common life together. And yet the amazing thing is, before the 1950s, almost nobody, no economists, no policymakers, no politicians, was talking about the idea of economic growth. Before the 1950s, there was really no reliable way to know how big the economy was, whether it was growing, and if it was growing, by how much. Where growth comes from, it's actually a product of war more than anything else. In the 1940s, the British government are at war, and a basic question when you're waging war is, how much of the economy can you slice up and dedicate to the war effort, and how much do you have to keep behind for civilian citizen needs? And the British government asked that question, but they couldn't answer it because there wasn't a measure of how big the British economy really was. And so the great British economist John Maynard Keynes, alongside American Simon Kuznets, developed what became known, actually not until the 1990s, as GDP. What put growth on the map, so this sort of relentless pursuit of GDP, was not the Second World War, but the Cold War, and so on. What happens is the size of the economies of the United States and of the Soviet Union become a kind of proxy measure of who is winning that Cold War, in part because the view is that the country with a larger economy will be able to fund a larger military in the event. Now, what then happens is the 20th century, it turns out the growth is associated with almost every measure of human flourishing. And so even when the demands of war fall away, the pursuit of growth remains. There's two big problems with the GDP measure. One are the sort of technical limitations of GDP, that it actually does quite a bad job measuring the amount of economic activity that takes place in the market in an economy. For instance, there are many things that are tremendously valuable but don't come with a price tag attached. There's also lots of things that, while they do appear and they do have a price, their quality changes very dramatically over time, and we're very bad at capturing those quality improvements. There's also a set of worries about the sort of moral limits of the GDP measure. There are many socially valuable things that we don't include in the GDP statistics, so the health of the environment, the level of inequality. But there are also many things which are not socially valuable that we do include. In the book, I trace out debates and disagreements about things like the economic value of prostitution and drugs and black markets and crime and so on. These are things which appear in certain technical calculations of the amount of activity that's taking place in the economy. But from a social point of view, it's not obvious that those are particularly valuable activities that we do want to include. The question of what things we value if not growth, and in turn, the question of how much we ought to value those things relative to one another, these are fundamental moral questions about what we care about as a society. And the place to answer those moral questions is not, in my view, in treasuries and central government statistical offices. It's not for technocrats and economists and statisticians to answer these questions, as they're trying to do today, but it's for citizens, it's for politics. I think large parts of the environmental movement and the degrowth movement in particular have misunderstood how growth actually works. And I set out in the book how little we know about economic growth, what it tells us, and how we can use that to get more economic growth. We should imagine that politicians and policymakers are like sailors on a boat, and they can put up the sails and go faster or pull them down and go slower, but they can also choose whatever direction they want on the open sea. It's one of the reasons I like that Nietzsche quotation at the end of the book so much, because it has this sea metaphor. We ought to try and choose both the quantity of growth that we enjoy in society, but also the kind of direction of growth, the quality, the nature of that growth as well. What do we do if we have to choose? What do we do if there really is a trade-off between growth and these other things that we care about? And that's where I think politics becomes very important, that these trade-offs, if we want to resolve them in legitimate ways, is in politics. I happen to believe that the pursuit of net zero and the pursuit of a greener type of growth is the right path for us to take. But that path comes at an economic cost. There are trade-offs involved. The growing discontent about the price that certain people and certain industries are paying for this green transition. We have to bring those people along on this alternative economic direction. Now, you have politicians like Caroline Lucas in the UK, environmentalists like David Attenborough, activists like Greta Thunberg, all appealing in different ways to the idea of degrowth. Part of the difficulty, though, is that when you actually look at what is meant by degrowth, it is extraordinarily confusing. There's a huge amount of confusion and disagreement. And part of what I'm trying to do in the book is, as an exercise, try and tease out exactly what it is that the degrowth movement is really after. And what you get is a kind of spectrum. At one end of the extreme is a very strong degrowth, which says we ought to either not simply press pause on economic growth, but even go into reverse, shrink certain economies around the world. And in my view, that sort of degrowth would be one of the greatest acts of self-harm that humankind could inflict upon itself. There is, though, the other end of the spectrum, and this is where I sit, where it's not about pursuing less growth or no growth, but it's about when we think about those trade-offs between growth and the climate, or growth and inequality, or whatever it might be, you recognize that there might be a price to be paid in terms of growth, and you say that that is a price worth paying, that you demote growth in the hierarchy of things that we collectively care about as a society. And I think there is merit in that. I think growth has sat at the center of our political and social lives for so long that it has a sort of primacy and importance that has led to a neglect of those other things that we might value and care about. Part of the reason for optimism is that I see this as opportunity for moral renewal, to pay more attention to the other valuable ends that we might have neglected until now through our very dogmatic focus on growth. Growth doesn't come from the world of finite resources. It comes from the world of ideas, by discovering new ideas about how to make use of those finite resources. And so the big question, I think, you're asking, what are their prospects? Their prospects will rise and fall depending upon their ability to generate more economic growth. And I have sort of two reflections on that. One is, despite the extraordinary importance of economic growth, we know surprisingly little about it. It's one of the great mysteries of economic thought and one of the great puzzles. The second thing I'd say, though, alongside the kind of the caution I think the Labour government needs to have but doesn't have with respect to growth because of the little we know about it, is that what they are doing, it seems to me, is sometimes at odds with the little we do know about growth. I mean, something we've been talking about is how growth doesn't come from the kind of world we can see and touch and drop on our feet. But those are the sorts of levers that political figures in this country are pulling at the moment. You know, building more houses, faster trains, wider roads, and so on. There's a sense that growth will come from doing big, impressive things in the material world. But my reading of the little we know about growth says it doesn't come from there, but from the world of ideas. Almost all of the big challenges that we face today involve some kind of international dimension. During the pandemic, I co-authored an article with former Prime Minister Gordon Brown on exactly this. That particular paper was focused more on international cooperation with respect to the pandemic, a feeling that we had just in so many different dimensions failed to rise to the occasion with respect to coordinating and cooperating across international borders. We are not going to respond effectively to the challenge of AI unless we have some kind of international cooperation and agreement. We're not going to respond to the challenge of climate change unless we do that. And so one of the most troubling, but also one of the most fascinating, it's a sort of double-edged thing, is that these technologies are forcing us to ask the question, what does it really mean to be human? What is humanity? You know, think about a faculty like creativity. Since I began thinking about the impact of technology on work almost 15 years ago, one of the things that people have said to me time and time again is that, look, Daniel, what you're talking about is all very well, but these machines will never be able to be creative. They'll never be able to do anything original, take us by surprise, come up with something novel. And for a long time, that seemed to be true. And so many people thought the core of what it means to be a human being is to be a creative thing. With the arrival of generative AI in the last few years, I think that has been really called into question. Systems like ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, DALL-E, Midjourney, the kind of tasks they are particularly good at doing are tasks that require creativity from us. I've always been slightly jealous of the sort of great storytellers in other branches of science outside the social sciences, particularly the great physicists who are able to tell these stories about the world and the universe. And partly it's about the kind of technical ideas, but it's also these extraordinary stories as well. And I suppose that's partly what I'm trying to do in my work, is take these relatively obscure, technical, dry, academic, difficult economic ideas and tell stories that make it far more accessible and engaging and interesting. One of the key themes of the book is that what drives growth in the end is technological progress. We discover new ideas about the world, we discover new ways of making use of finite resources that we have, and another word for that is that we generate technological progress. And so one of the arguments of the book is that we have a choice. We not only have more or less growth, but we can also change the nature of growth. The same is true of our technologies too. It's the same story. We can have more technological progress and less technological progress, but we can also have different types of technological progress. We can develop technologies and society that make us more prosperous, but also don't damage the environment, don't widen inequalities in society. And so actually, deeper down, it really is a book about technology, because at the moment, I think we've got the wrong kind. And those two previous books are a kind of look at arguably the sort of wrong kind of technological progress. I worry that in decades to come, technology might have a very harmful impact on our working lives. And so in a way, this book is a kind of generalization of those ideas that I developed in those earlier books. We need to get far more people into the parts of the economy that are responsible for generating ideas. We need to use the technology that we have itself. And this is one of the most radical and I think most exciting parts of the book. We need to use the technologies we have themselves to generate new ideas about the world. In the 20th century, many of our best ideas came from the heads of very smart human beings. In the 21st century, it seems to me our best ideas are not going to come from us. They're going to come from these technologies. And we can already catch a glimpse of that. I think one of the technologies I've been particularly excited by in the last few years was AlphaFold, which was a technology developed by DeepMind to solve protein folding problem in biology during the pandemic, and just paying more attention to the natural environment and the trees and the plants and the animals on walks and then in my own garden. And now I'm completely obsessed. At the moment, I am collecting seeds. It's very fun to do with my children. As a team, the three of us collecting seeds at the moment, getting ready for next year. Lots of labeled jars and trays of seeds drying out, and we'll get planting in a few months.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.